Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Bang Future Lab, the podcast where we explore the forces reshaping our world through AI, robotics, and exponential technologies. My name is Jens de Boer. I'm the founder of DOOP, and I'm the founder and the host of the Big Bang Initiatives. I'm a journalist, author, and a longtime observer of global innovation. I've spent years interviewing leaders and studying how AI and digital transformation are changing business, society, and geopolitics. Our mission is simple: reduce noise, increase clarity, understand what truly matters. And I'm really, really happy to have a co-host here from the US. It's Arvin van Graelen, and it's really good to see you, Arvin.
Yes, my friend. I'm so happy to be co-hosting with you on this. We've been talking about it for a couple months. I have been in this AI and XR and cybersecurity semiconductor field for 35 years. I've seen multiple waves of industry revolutions in this technology. I'm currently doing research at Stanford, and I'm teaching at MIT. And I've written a book called Our Next Reality about essentially how this technology is going to unfold in the next 10 years and what we need to do about it. So I think that's kind of the theme of what we're going to talk about on the show is, what's happening and what do you need to do about it?
And it's really fantastic. We have met first at South by South in Austin, and you are a real expert. And you see everything from both sides, from the US, from the Chinese side, and I support you a little bit from the European side, what's going on right now.
So we've got all three major continents covered.
Yeah, we hope so. And that brings us today to the central theme. Are we moving from a brute force scaling race to a more collaborative, design-driven era of AI? Let's dive in. And for the last 5 years, AI progress has been defined by a simple idea: more GPUs, more intelligence. NVIDIA has been the engine of that growth, but the ecosystem seems to be shifting. How stable is NVIDIA's advantage as the industry moves from brute force scaling to a smarter model designed by more collaborative development?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question, and it's an important question because right now the entire industry is built on the assumption that the more CPUs you put in, the bigger the models, the smarter they get. I started in the semiconductor industry in the early 90s, and I was actually late 80s. I was building chips that I was helping Intel create the instruction sets that became what NVIDIA is using today in their CUDA sets, right? Something called MMX. But what I'm seeing now is that there's actually a shift. Right. The trillions of dollars that we are now putting, or the world is now putting into data centers around the world, assumes that you have to make the models bigger to be smarter. But over the last couple of years, what we're seeing, the trend is actually changing. For probably about the last five of the last seven years, it was all about scaling, and the scaling laws was the big idea. Right now, the last 1 or 2 years, what we're finding is that actually there's a bit of a descaling law, what I call descaling laws, things like, going from training time compute to now test time compute. It means that the longer you run it, the smarter it gets. So you actually need less GPUs, but as long as you run it longer, it gives you linear growth, right? And now with things like distillation, with new algorithmic techniques, with just new ways of architecting these systems, we're able to get trillion parameter model performance on tens or maybe 100 billion parameter models, which means that you can run it on a lot less hardware and get maybe just 1 or 2% reduction in accuracy. So it's well worth the cost. In fact, right now what we're finding is that all the models now are able to get very similar performances no matter where they're trained. And that's really kind of putting a wrench into the assumptions that people have had.
But right now, for us in Europe and all over the world, NVIDIA is something, it's a money machine, and it's something everybody relies on and said that's the future. So you doubt that this will be the future too for the AI field, that NVIDIA is not so dominant anymore in the future?
Well, I think it's right now, you know, NVIDIA is probably 80-90% of the training compute in the world. And that's a very dominant market share. You know, and it's also because in the past, really, there was no real competition, right? You know, at least on the training side, on the cloud side. What we're finding now is that, you know, you have, AMD's coming up with their new solutions. You have, Google's coming up with their TPUs. You have Chinese coming with their Huawei chips. You know, so there's a lot more other chips that are now able to provide, you know, similar, if not sometimes better performance when you group them together. So, from a training perspective, I think it's very difficult for any company to maintain the dominant market share that NVIDIA has today. And if you don't have that dominant market share, you also won't be able to maintain the margins that they have had. I mean, their net margins are crazy. You know, I'm doing very well these days. I mean, they're really the only company in the AI industry today that is making money consistently. And in some ways, that sounds great for them, but it's a very precarious place to be when the rest of your customers are not really making money yet.
And there is a player in, there's China as a player. Do you see that China will have a more dominant role in the future because they are very smart, they are doing a very good job, and we have had this DeepSeek moment month ago? And do you see in the future maybe that there are Chinese solutions which can be very difficult for NVIDIA?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just in the future. You know, since DeepSeek in earlier this year, it really proved that a small team with a small number of processors can create a very capable model. And over this entire year, the gap between open source models and closed source models have continued to converge. In fact, a week ago, Kimi K2 Thinking was released, and that model was essentially just as powerful as the leading closed frontier models. And it was made by a lab with a couple hundred people and maybe 10,000 chips compared to, you know, the hundreds of thousands or millions of chips that the closed labs are showing. And what that really proves is you don't need giant data centers to train capable models. And what's even more important is that those, the Chinese models now are optimized to work on smaller systems because they just don't have them at home and, you know, in their home market. And so you can run that Kimi K2 model on two Mac minis. Right, two Mac minis, you can run it at home and get the performance of something that would take racks of servers for the leading Western models. And I think that changes the equation in terms of what people have expected for a very long time.
But there is a big problem, because the problem of trust. But not a lot of people trust the Chinese technology. And I think this DeepSeek moment was only for a few months, a few weeks a moment. Now, but nobody cares about it.
Yeah. So I think there's the issue of trust in terms of running the models that are being operated in Chinese servers in China. But the issue is right now, if you look at what's happening, all the models that are coming out of China are actually open source. And what that means is that they are now, they show you how they work. They give you the weights, they give you the papers. So they're essentially sharing the learning and innovation that's happening, and you can tune it to whatever way you want. In fact, what's happening right now is almost, I would say 80 to 90% of startups in the world today are using Chinese open source models, for their operation, because they can't afford the big, you know, closed source models. It could be, you know, 50 or 100 times the price to use closed source versus the open source models. And because it's transparent, because it's open source, you can modify any way you want. So you really don't have to worry about trust. You don't have to worry about sending data to anywhere else. You could run it on your own on-premise or on your own private cloud. So I think that changes what the a lot of people assume about Chinese models.
The problem is problem about the future is that nobody knows what really happens. And months ago, everybody told me, years or months ago, that Google will be the loser of everything. You said nobody will use the search machine of Google, and they will. You have to sell all your stocks, and this is the loser. But it's the opposite. Because right now the stock is going well. Gemini is fantastic. And Warren Buffett, he is an investor in Coca-Cola, and he's very, very yeah, what is it? A conservative investor. He announced a few days ago that he will buy or has already bought lots of stocks of Google. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I mean, Google is actually, they were the main juggernaut. They were kind of the open AI of this industry probably 5-6 years ago. And they were the ones that came out with the Transformer paper, which all of the current language models are based on. But they didn't really take it out to market, I think, for two major reasons. One is that they're probably afraid of cannibalizing their search market by introducing a use case that might reduce the search traffic. But the other thing is, I think they also have a little bit more sense of, you know, should we be using this for, you know, are there dangers? Is there safety issues? And so, you know, I actually have a lot of respect for Demis Hassabis, who's the lead of the AI efforts at Google, and I think they've done amazing things, and you know, they created AlphaFold and you know, Genome and all these other things that are really more science focused AI models that are not about creating AGI, but really taking AI to create solutions for real world problems. So in some ways, I feel like they've been moving slowly. But they have, you know, thousands and thousands of researchers in this space. So they have a very deep talent, and they also have their own compute. So they're not a slave to any other third party vendor in terms of hardware. And that gives an advantage, because they don't have to compete to see if they can get the allocations from NVIDIA for training. Right. So I think the combination of their, you know, their strong talent pool, their long-term pedigree in the space, and their own hardware, as well as they have huge amounts of data, right? They have so much search data around the world. They have, you know, the YouTube data to get videos. So now what they're doing is that with the new Gemini 3 that just came out, it's actually right now the leading model in the world, you know, bar none. It just clearly they have outperformed every model, with this. And the assumption right now in the industry is actually, you know, they will continue to probably take the lead from now going forward, because now they are actually serious about putting out solutions to the world, whereas before they were more holding back with some internal conflict.
And for you personally, what do you think? Who's the winner in this race right now? We have in the race, we have Meta, we have Google, we have Microsoft or OpenAI, somebody else?
So I think this is the issue today, is that there's a bit of a false narrative of a race condition, because people seem to feel that there's a finish line, right? And the finish lines, most people think, at least in the Silicon Valley, is like they want to get to AGI. And they think, if I create AGI, I create a $1 trillion machine for making money. Okay. So AGI is artificial general intelligence. That's essentially the idea that now I can create AI that is as smart as any human, and it can essentially take over all the cognitive labor, and it keeps learning, so it becomes smarter over time. Right. That's the idea. And you know, and it's now being politicized to become a geopolitical discussion between, you know, is it a race between US and China? You know, if we slow down, will China win? And there's a lot of kind of regulatory capture that's happening today, where these major labs in the Silicon Valley are going to Washington, D.C. and telling them, don't regulate us, because if you regulate us, you'll slow us down and China will win. And then, you know, we'll lose to China. And I feel like that's a bit of a false narrative that is actually dangerous for the world. Because this technology is very powerful and can be used for good. And we can see that. And it could also be used for bad. And if we, you know, completely take away all the safety guardrails, there's a higher chance it will be used for bad. And you know, we're not putting in the right safeguards to keep it safe. And we're not putting in the right policies to keep people in a safer and more responsible way to use it. Right? So we need to really reframe this race from a winner takes all scenario, which everybody thinks right now, whoever gets there first wins everything. And what we're seeing right now with all the launches essentially every week, there's a switch in position of who's in the lead, right? So what that means is, first of all, there is no finish line. Two is that, you know, is it really worth it to spend billions of dollars is what, you know, Google and OpenAI and Anthropic and X, all of them are spending on essentially a quarterly basis to try to build these models, right? And it's unclear, because if you build a model within a few weeks, it gets overtaken. You know, how much is that temporary lead really worth? And it's very unclear.
So it could be that you spend a lot of money, and in 3-4 months another will come along and will be the.
It's actually three four weeks. It's not 3-4 months. that's the thing. It's, you know, and some of these models cost tens of billions of dollars right now to train, tens of billions for one training run. Now, if you look at what's happening in China, the Kimi K2 model that just launched a week or two ago, it was trained for $4.6 million. Right. So $4.6 million, and then, you know, Google and Grok and OpenAI spending billions per model. So this is essentially a 100-to-1 ratio in terms of costs. And I'm not sure if that investment is the right place to be putting everybody's essentially the entire tech industry now is built on this, right? In fact, if you look at the American GDP this year, it was about a 2% growth so far this year, and 90% of it was based on building out data centers, right? It's a very lopsided, overweighted on this particular one type of model of growing intelligence.
But as for me as an entrepreneur, if I will use it, it's not only for doing some papers and some speeches. Sorry, it's a question of agentic AI too. How do you see it right now?
Well, I think that the next phase is agentic. Right now, you know, the last couple of years has been more the chat model, right? Essentially, you ask a question, you get an answer back. You put in a prompt, you get a picture back. You know, that type of a model. Essentially, what agentic AI does is that now you can give it a longer term task. You may say, hey, do a program that does this, or you know, make me a video that does that, or help me do stock trading that you know maximizes my returns. In fact, there was a contest the last 2-3 weeks called Alpha Arena. I don't know if you saw that, but essentially they pitted the top 6 models in the world, and they said, here's $10,000 of cryptocurrency. You can trade any cryptocurrency you want, and you know, we'll look at the returns and we'll compare it to just how well is Bitcoin doing as a baseline. Right. And essentially, after a couple of weeks, right now, I think Quan from Alibaba and DeepSeek are the two leaders. They both maybe make something like 10 to 30%, something in that range. And, OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, they've all lost money. I think OpenAI might have lost the most. They've lost probably 50, 60% over a 2-3 period. Right. So what that's showing is that, you know, at least on a real world task of trying to make money using agents, where you're not putting any humans in the loop, you're just saying, you know, you trade based on what data you're getting. The very low cost, free, cheap models that are coming out of China is actually outperforming the US models that cost trillion or billions of dollars to train. So I think that's a very interesting development.
We talk a lot about US, we talk a lot about China. Do you have any ideas? Do you see on the somewhere Europe?
Well, I think Europe actually is not in as bad a position as a lot of people think. As you know, I was in Europe recently, and a lot of times when I talk to European leaders and corporate leaders, they always are saying, "Oh, you know, we're so behind. We regulate ourselves, and now we can't innovate, and we have, you know, there's no investment here." And you know, I think we need to separate the idea of invention versus diffusion, because it's not real, and history shows this. It's not the company or the country that invents the technology first that succeeds. It's the country or the company that diffuses that technology to a large number of users as quickly as possible without hurting their own market, right? If you look at, you know, I spent the last 15 of the last 20 years working, living in China, and I've seen the growth of what's happening over there. And most of the things that are making it successful were not invented in China, but they brought it in, they diffused it, they put it into all the parts of industry. And, you know, now they've grown their market, you know, tenfold plus over the last 10-15 years in terms of of economic growth and the quality of life, right? And now they are the manufacturing capital of the world, right? They didn't invent the robots for manufacturing. They didn't invent, the technology that's used for solar cells or for thorium reactors, or but now they're leading the world in these places. In fact, the rapid fast trains that are made in China that they dominate today was actually invented in Germany first, and they took some of those designs and brought it to China and then optimized it for the local market, right? So I think the key is how can Europe take that same idea? How can they take these AI models that are now open source, anybody can have access to, deploy it to the industry, to the economy, without cratering the system? In fact, I think Europe has a good chance to do it because you have such a good social safety net. And when you deploy this technology, what's going to happen in places like America is that they will say, oh, I'm getting a 50% increase in productivity. I'm going to fire, half my staff, or maybe 30 or 40% of my staff, because now I can. And when you do that, it creates an economic shock to the economy, to the labor force, to social stability. Whereas in Europe, it's harder to fire people. So they will say, okay, let me deploy them to somewhere else. Let me retrain them to do something else. So there's a slower pace of impact. Maybe I'll give them a 4-day work week instead of a 3-day work week. I think those are the kind of things that European leaders will start to think about. Whereas American leaders will say, hey, I just had this big increase. Let me fire 100,000 people, 500,000 people. In fact, if you look at, Amazon, they announced, last few weeks, they're firing tens of thousands of white collar workers. And then over the next 2-3 years, they're going to fire 600,000 warehouse workers, because they're going to bring in robots to do warehouse work. And then probably after that, they're going to fire a lot of the delivery workers, because now they're getting, autonomous drivers and a robot to deliver, right? So those type of decisions will be much harder in Europe to make. And I think in some ways, it's a better thing for society, because our economy needs time to adjust to these social shocks and economic shocks that AI will bring.
A few days ago, I was in an event with the Vice Chancellor of Germany, Lars Klingbeil, and they spoke about the future, 1 hour about the future. And can you imagine that there was the word AI was not mentioned one time when they spoke about the future, and the audience didn't ask anything about it, because for them, it was, I think, far away, that we are living in more or less two bubbles right now. Do you believe in that?
Yeah, I think there's a certain sense of safety from hiding from what's coming. Because if you tell people, there's always been more jobs created, and this thing's nothing to be scared of, it makes you feel good today. But it also does something very dangerous, is that you stop to prepare for it. You don't make the changes in policy. You don't make the economic adjustments. You don't prepare your staff for this change. And when that happens, when it does come, it's going to be a bigger shock. So it's a little bit disappointing to hear that somebody in that position of what you're describing isn't helping make this alerting the country and the region to what is coming, because it's very clear that it is coming. In fact, the last 2 months, I've probably interviewed about 50 plus CEOs of companies who are implementing AI solutions. This is part of my research I'm doing at Stanford right now. And I'm asking them, what are you doing with it? How are you applying it? What's making it work? What's not? And, I can see across the board, the companies that are doing it well are getting multi-X, 200, 500% increase in productivity or efficiency or cost reductions. And, their plan is to, at some point in the near future, reduce their workforce. Or reduce hiring, or let attrition happen without replacement. They're going to focus on reducing costs because they can, right? And to hide from that reality is actually, I think, irresponsible for people who are in positions of policy today.
And you know what? I think it's very important for people like us to talk about it and to bring this information of change and, the chances and the risks to the people. And so I'm really happy that we have here, that you are here in the show. And it was a powerful and a wonderful discussion. And I think, every 2 weeks or every week, we will have a Big Bang Future Lab. It depends on the information side, what we can talk about it. And we break down the tectonic shifts shaping the future of AI and robotics with honesty, clarity, and a global perspective. And so please join us. Please come with us. Send us some emails. And, the future is accelerating. Join us in our show. And Evan, what are your remarks, the last remarks? Something positive I need.
Yes, I've actually enjoyed this show. And I think we're going to really help people understand this complex issue. And, please, like and subscribe and share this podcast. And if you have any questions you want us to talk about, because I think we are going to provide a honest and transparent analysis of these issues. So please let us know what you want us to talk about. We'll try to cover as much as possible.
Thank you.